views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the board, staff, underwriters, and donors of Voice of Vashon. Ladies and gentlemen, hey, thanks for tuning in today to Adventures in Recovery. Tom Walston, your host every Tuesday at 1:30 here on the Voice of Vashon, at the beautiful Isle of Vashon, Washington. I am so pleased to have such an interesting guest on our show today. And I was lucky enough to attend a international or a national convention about 3 weeks ago that was hosted in Seattle. It was what was called the NADAC Convention, which stands for the National Association of Drug and Alcohol Counselors. And part of that conference, and there were hundreds of us there, part of that conference was hearing some really incredible speakers share their story. Now, one of the topics that appealed to me for whatever reason was the importance of humor in recovery. And lo and behold, there was the speaker's name, which happened to be Tom Farley. And some of you might recognize the last name because he is actually the oldest brother in the Farley family, which would include Chris Farley from Saturday Night Live, from Tommy Boy, from Beverly Hills Ninja, and the list goes on and on. Tom, welcome.
Oh, so good to be here, and so good to kind of remember that. That was a great conference. I love talking about humor, especially to clinicians and counselors, because I don't think we get we don't appreciate humor in our lives as much as we do in the work we do, and I think that's a shame, because it's definitely necessary, and so wonderful to do that, wonderful to meet people that feel the same way.
It gets
that we got connected.
It gets so clinical. It's like we need to balance it out with with something make it a little bit more human. So speaking of human, would you mind sharing a little bit of your story with us? We don't have a ton of time, but I'm always curious where people came from. And I know you had an interesting family and the dynamics were all there. So take it away.
Thank you. Well, I mean, grew up in Madison, Wisconsin, where I actually live back again. Now, Midwestern, Irish, so heavy drinking cultures kind of abound, everywhere you look, every angle you look at the Farleys.
And Catholic,
yeah. So we connected to drinking about 20 different ways. And it wasn't so much a problem to us that we thought, because it was very normative. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until one of us started to struggle with it, and that would be Chris. Mm. And even though we were all had kind of more than our share of drinking issues with drinking, Chris kind of he went on to the next and the next. And on top of that, he also, had this level of success in the comedy world that was like, oh my gosh, we can't let him kind of mess this up. So we learned quickly to make this not about a Farley family issue. It was Chris's issue.
Mm-hmm.
And so we learned that, I realized later is we weren't really able to help Chris as much as we should have as a family or wanted to, because I think deep down we kind of realized and knew that to do that, we'd have to be honest about our own issues.
Bingo.
And we didn't want to do that, so we made a Chris's problem. And it had wonderful times of, when I lived out in and worked out in New York, and Chris was at Saturday Night Live, I got to see him in recovery. It was like, I didn't really know what I was looking at. I was like, but it was a different Chris, and it was great to see. I fortunate that I got to see that. But then Chris died, and very publicly, obviously, and I did something very unlike all those different cultures that I mentioned. I kind of knew I had to talk about it, mm-hmm. you know, this pain and this grief. So I went into schools, kind of teaching connection, teaching, you know, the power of improv and humor that my brothers taught me, all my brothers who went through Second City and became comedians. I wanted to bring that to a younger, you know, Chris's audience. You know, I went into schools, and I probably helped a lot of people, but, I didn't realize till much, much later that I was doing was telling somebody else's story, you know, and avoiding mine. Even when I wrote the book, the biography of Chris, and was, you know, honest about that. We can talk about it later, but it was still somebody else's story. It wasn't until years later when I had bouts of sobriety. You know, I put 4 or 5 years together only to not be able to sustain it because I was just being sober, but I was still having all of life's, you know, train wrecks kind of happen, you know, and stresses. And the only way I learned how to manage those things was to numb it, was to drink. And so, you know, I put 5 years of sobriety together, followed by, you know, another 10 years of not being sober. And I did that 7 years ago. I tried again, and actually today is my 7-year anniversary, yeah, in recovery.
Wow.
And I
today?
Today. Yes.
Oh my God, way to go. Yeah. That is awesome.
Yeah. But even then I stopped drinking, doing the only thing I knew how to do, which was stop. And it wasn't until 4 months after that a really good friend of mine, a clinician that I had worked with for teen IOP groups in her clinic, just happened to call me up. I had lost touch, and she said, "How you doing?" And I said, very proudly, "You know, I haven't had a drink in 4 months," expecting a lot more applause than I got. And she's like, "That's great. We should have coffee." I said, "I'd love to have coffee." She goes, "Great. Well, meet me Saturday morning, 9 a.m. in the basement of the Presbyterian Church." I'm like, "Damn it!" You know, okay, I know where this is going.
Exactly.
You know, because all those times before I had gone to meetings and I would listen to somebody across the room share, and it was just like Chris in our family. Like, I'd say, like, that person drinks more than me. I guess I'm okay.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not that bad. And so I went again and I started, and it was somebody that had helped a lot of people in our community. It was my first surrendering to a higher power. I didn't say no to this person I know has helped so many people. And I said, okay, I'll go. And I, you know, surrendered that. And then I started to hear, not that person across drinks more than me. I started hearing, oh my gosh, I've had broken relationships like that person. I've had job loss like that person. I've had financial stress like that person. And I realized, this isn't about drinking, not drinking. I just needed the clarity, the sobriety to work on all these things that I was hearing. Stuff like, I can't tell you the first time I heard the words rigorous honesty. Yeah. And I'm like, first of all, I'm Irish, and I was a marketing NPR kind of professional by trade. And so, like, I knew the gray areas of truth. I knew how to craft a good story, but like rigorous, like I didn't think that was a thing. And so I started to, you know, lean on these things like gratitude and humility and all these tools that I've learned. And then I did something really, really different. I started going and starting in the rooms, but then going out like I did, you know, in my public speaking. But this time I wasn't telling somebody else's story, I was telling my story.
Wow.
And what blew me away was all of a sudden I was getting the one thing that I desperately wanted my entire life. I was getting connection. People were coming up to me, not like, you know, that was the interesting story about your brother. They were coming up to me and saying, like, I heard your story, but that's my story. I was hearing my story and you telling your story. And, like, all of a sudden, like, we're connected. And I haven't looked back since. I need it more and more. That as I like to say, we tell our stories because we can't heal in isolation, you know?
Yep.
And every place I go to now, I tell them, I remind them one thing. It's like, yes, you came here to hear me talk, but I'm not here to motivate you, or maybe I am, who knows? But I want you to understand one thing. What you're really hearing is me healing. Mm-hmm. And I have to constantly do that. Every time I talk, I heal. And I can't get enough of it because I feel so good about the connection that I have and the healing that I feel. And oh my gosh. Yeah.
Well, you know,
didn't see that coming.
Funny how our higher power has some surprises in store for us when we surrender.
God.
When I say surrender, I just mean crossing over to the winning side.
Yeah, you know? and taking the ego out of it. Just like, yeah, it's just, and really, as I said, I got really good, you know, early on in, you know, maybe starting to, early, I mean, where the, of starting to create and curate this person that I thought the world wanted me to be, that I thought I needed to be, and it was so much management into creating this inauthentic person. And now that I have kind of leaned into the vulnerability of finding out who is this. First, so I was creating this person I thought I wanted to be, and then I became, on top of that, somebody's brother. And so now I had to be,
oh, yeah.
You know, I used to say, like, I used to joke, like, my full name for the longest time was Tom Farley, brother of Chris Farley, who died of a drug overdose. That was my full name.
Yeah.
And now, going out and telling my story, I just get to be Tom again.
Wow. How liberating.
Not again, for the first time. Oh, you have no idea. Yeah.
Free at last.
You know, But Chris is still part of it. He's still my brother, and I'm doing what I'm doing. I'm in recovery, kind of, you know, finishing up his recovery, getting, you know, living the life he never got a chance to live. So he's still there, but it's me doing it. It's my story.
Well, you know, Tom, when I was finishing the book last night, I was reflecting on what a beautiful, and by the way, folks, if you haven't read the book, and it's been out for a while, but it's called The Chris Farley Show by Tom Farley. And but what a beautiful legacy Chris left.
Oh, you know, it's funny. And it's one of the things I talk in some of my talks about myself, but I know it was true for Chris as well, is I could be in the middle of a room or, okay, let's be honest, a bar. I could be in the middle of a bar surrounded by people, center of attention, making everyone laugh, and yet not feeling more like I was standing on the surface of the moon. It's like I'm giving people what they want from me. Why do I feel this way? Why do I feel like they don't know me? And Chris felt the same way, like there was a person that he wanted to show the world that he didn't think they wanted to see, or he wasn't able to show them. And it's that we all feel that at some point, and it's brutal.
Well, how many times at a meeting have we heard other people share that they never really felt like they fed in? They always felt like kind of the hole in the donut. And that's one thing several millions of us in recovery, or not even in recovery yet, perhaps, have had identity issues.
Yeah.
It's like, who am I? Okay,
of course.
I'll be whoever. Just tell me who you want me to be, and I can be that.
Right. And I'll put the effort in to be that. And because, you know, to be honest, it's easier to do that, even as hard as it is to maintain that. It's easier to do that than to do the initial step of finding your authentic self, which is being vulnerable. At first, that vulnerability is hard, it's scary, it's painful. But what we don't realize when we start to do that, and being vulnerable and being rigorously honest, is that all of a sudden what was hard at first all of a sudden isn't, because you're showing your authentic self to the world and the world is responding and you're getting that connection and people are coming back, and all of a sudden this isn't painful anymore. It's actually, mm-hmm. you know, getting me what I always wanted. Like, you know, people, like, you know, they want us. Well, part of that like being this, creating this person that I thought the world wanted me, part of that was controlling everyone else around me so that I could be that person. Like my wife and my family have to be this way so I could be that person. My employer has to give me that job, not the one I have, that one. You don't understand. I need to be this person. And no one wants to be, you know, controlled like that. And so when you start to be honest with yourself and people see that you're being honest and truthful with yourself, then you're not a threat. And then you're like, okay, you're not going to, you know, try to control me. Like, I can be honest with you because you started it. You show that's where you want to be too.
And we don't have to present any false images of ourselves. For once, we're comfortable within our own skin. And the nice thing, the thing I love about recovery is you associate yourself with other people that are real and that are authentic, and they'll call you on your crap, and you respect them for that, and you hear it.
You know what's funny? I said a couple times now, like I grew up in this with this notion of like I had to find my tribe, and my tribe, you know, was defined. There were people I grew up in the same neighborhood with, went to the same schools, same church, you know, same country clubs. If that's, you know, that's my, that's my tribe. But I never felt fully comfortable with those people. Mm-hmm. And another thing, my tribe, if you will, didn't have tattoos. My tribe had all their teeth. You know what? Here in recovery, I'm sitting here with a bunch of people with a lot of tattoos and half their teeth, and I'm loving every freaking minute of it. Like, I feel so, the sense of belonging I feel, doesn't matter what, you know, the packaging is, it's what's underneath, like this, I belong here with these people, like this is a connection. I wow.
Well, we've got our family of origin, but then we have our family of choice. And what I heard one person say really summed it up by saying, my friends I meet in recovery range from Park Avenue to Park Bench.
Yeah.
And that's so true.
God, that's so true. So true.
Yep.
You know? And not only are they helping you to find your authentic self, but you're doing the same for them.
Exactly. It's a two-way street.
And when you see that, it's so, so powerful and beautiful. And like when you get to do that together, you know, wow.
Well, I don't want to be a spoiler about the book, but I got to tell you, one of the areas I found so emotional was the fact that, because alcohol was pretty present in your family, as it was in mine, a Catholic family, went to boys' school, went to, you know, just like all the brothers in your family. And so many things were never talked about. You can talk about sports, you can talk about this, you can talk about that, but if it gets too real, back off, okay? But the miracle was, after Chris's funeral, your dad never had another drink.
Yeah.
That was kind of a God thing.
That up. It was sad to see how it was hard to watch. You know, where he was emotionally, having lost his son, but it would have been so much worse. Like, but he showed that pain because he was, he wasn't hiding it or drowning it or numbing it. He was showing it, which made it sadder, but also real, you know. And I had empathy for that father than I would have never had empathy for it, a father that continued, you know, down, you know, the road that he was always on, you know.
Well, it made it real quick.
Well, just like with my father, you know, said with, you know, same with Chris, it's because of all this work that I've done and being open off, like I'm able to, I have been able to separate this brother with an addiction and a disease from this brother that I love. Mm-hmm. And those are two separate people. And a lot of people continue to carry that person, like those people that we've lost, like all of that. And at any given time, I could have a different emotion. I could have regret about one of those people and not feel the empathy about the brother I love. So I like, you have to separate.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I want to understand the addictive Chris and the pain and the trauma that he was going through, but I also want to retain, you know, and grow, and I still have that opportunity to grow that love and relationship. I, you know, with this brother I love, I say because, and it's funny, the way I wrote the book, if I wrote the book at that time, like here's my buyer, my thought, it would not have been as impactful as it was. Instead, I interviewed these people that knew Chris from growing up, from college, from this, and it just hit me so hard. Like, oh my God, they saw different parts of Chris that I hadn't seen at all. I like to say I have a better relationship with my brother now than I ever did when he was alive.
Oh yeah, it rounded him out.
I mean, people saw. Like it helped me, you know, like any of the other emotions or regrets or resentments that I may have had. Like I got to separate that out, and like, no, this is where, like, this is where the relationship should be.
Well, we're all such multifaceted individuals, and I got to tell you, since we're running out of time, and I could talk with you for hours. This is fascinating.
Right? I know.
But I want to. Speaking of the work that you do, can you do a real quick capsulization about your involvement with recovery.org?
Recovery.com.
Recovery.com. There we go. Sorry.
And it's here right in my hometown of Madison, the startup. It's a tech company that's really focused on, you know, patient first, like finding the best treatment, like taking down the barriers. Not like where's an open bed, but like what do you need, do you need addiction treatment or is it really mental health stuff? But we need sometimes co-occurring, you know, gets, you know, some one gets in the way of the other, and so it's really this: where is the best place for you, and real with some real ethics. A lot of people are turning to the internet to find help these days, but the internet's a scary place, and we wanted to build it, you know, like, but also, and also, like, you're pushed into treatment, like, your family tells you need to go, your doctor says you maybe had an intervention, but, like, and we say, okay, I'll go, but recovery.com also now has all these content and resources at the end of the end, where people can build up this understanding of this, you know, thing they have.
Well, check this out, because, I mean, this was brought to my attention by a client a few weeks ago. She really needed treatment bad, fentanyl, the usual, but meth, I shouldn't say the usual, but it's not uncommon.
Yep.
And, but what are we going to do with my dog? And I'll tell you what, there's a lot of homeless people out there that their dog is their family. And if they will not go into
I just spoke at a conference here in Minnesota in St. Paul, and I met a brand new company here. It's called Serenity Kennel, and it's like, it's for that reason alone. It's like, it's not just, like, what do I do with my dog? Like, we'll take your dog, and then maybe he'll bring people bring the dog over during therapy or whatever, but it's like, why didn't somebody think of this before? Like, holy shnikes.
Serenity Kennel. God, I'm so glad you brought that up.
I'm glad you were there. I literally just learned about it today. That was amazing.
Well, sharing, I call them God shots. You know, there are no coincidences in recovery. And when I met you, the only reason I got to have the pleasure of meeting you, Tom, was there was a colleague, a good friend of mine, that works for Recovery Beyond out here. And I saw him sitting on a couch by himself. I'm going, hey, what's going on, Taylor? He says, well, you see that guy over there? I go, yeah. He said, I'm so nervous.
He's totally stuck.
I really want to go. Yeah. I want to go meet him, but I'm so nervous. And, you know, I'm kind of a ballsy guy, and I've always been a little obnoxious. I said, come on, we're going over there. And you were,
let's go.
You were perusing the books. You remember that?
Exactly.
And there's my little friend. I said, hey, just to break the ice with you, I said, oh, you finding any good books? And then I looked at your name tag. I said, wait a minute. You know.
Yeah, that was great. That was great. I'm glad he got the courage and help to come over, because it was fun. And here we are today because of it. So.
And then you were nice enough to share the clap with him. And we need to clarify that a little bit. It was a technique.
Please do.
The clapping technique that you used, that you shared with a lot of the audience when they got up, and it's like,
oh,
okay, we're going to make the connection with other people. You recall that?
I'm going to have so much. Yes, of course I do. I just did it in this presentation I just made just now. But I'm going to definitely share, like, how you the setup there was beautiful, what you just said.
Sharing the clap.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Well, hearing you share your story in Minneapolis warms my heart, because that's where I grew up. And I know we have some friends in common there that are pretty well known in the recovery field. And that's where it all started with me, 20 years of bartending, trying to be a performer behind the bar. And that alcohol.
Oh, my gosh.
The alcohol, for me, was the glue that adhered the armor to me to keep everybody an arm's distance away.
Right. Yeah. I thought that was connection. But, man.
Yep. Look what it did for you. Look what it did for me, and it brought us all, most of us, into the wonderful world of meeting other like-minded people, and we're all healing together.
And you know what I love what you're doing, what we just did is, yes, we have to talk about where we've been, and yes, we have to make an inventory of all the stuff, but I want to talk about what this gift that I was given, like this stuff that these wonderful things that, here's my inventory of defects, but like, here's also an inventory of like, this life in recovery is amazing. So I'll look back if you want me to, but that person is nothing compared to like the person I'm living now. It's what a gift.
Yep. And there's no shame in the game, because it took all of that to get us all where we're at right now.
Yeah.
Right?
Absolutely. Oh, 100%. Yeah, I wouldn't change a thing,
Yeah.
I love the people that come into the rooms. 30 years. I started when I was 20. I'm like, I don't know, but that's amazing. There's no way I could have done it. But I'm here now, like, it's not about that. It's about,
it's about life.
Yeah.
It's about life. Well, I'll tell you what, my friend, Tom, a huge hug out to you, especially for your 7 years today. My God, what a miracle that is. And, I would love to have you back on here sometime. And if you're ever back out in the Seattle area, and we're a little island right off of Seattle and called Vashon Island, a little town of 10,000 people,
awesome.
Where we have our own radio station, and we're going to be going to the next level. So
that's awesome. I was out there 2 weeks ago before this thing where I met you. I was out at Port Angeles.
Wow! What?
Wow! Yeah, they brought me out there for, and like, in, like, it's like, oh, man, I thought I was going to Seattle. No, you're going 2 hours beyond. And it was beautiful. It was this beautiful town, and they were doing some great work out there. And yeah, it's great. And before that, I went out twice. I spoke a couple times at Lewis McChord.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I love speaking to veterans and military. So that was special, too. So, like, I get out there a lot more than I have been.
I love the fact that you love talking. And we got to say sayonara.
Right?
Thanks again. Thanks again, my friend. I love you, Tom.
No,
and
so good.
Keep in touch with yourself.
Yeah, absolutely.
And keep spreading the clap.
Yeah, all of that. Yeah, this is how I end things. I like you and I are definitely on the same page. I love it.
All right. Take care, my friend. Thanks again, Tom.
Thanks, Tom.
Bye-bye.
You bet. See ya.